This is Mobile Patron, Suit Patron, Down Patron. And this is the special October bonus episode for our patrons. October is a very spooky month.
Ooh.
It's a month when the barrier between the worlds of the living and the dead becomes a little bit thinner, and some of the ghosts rise again. So we thought it would be a good month to do a retrospective on all of our funerary memorial tributes from the first year of Mobile Suit Breakdown.
It became clear very quickly that we were not going to be able to memorialize every character who died in First Gundam. So we stuck to some combination of characters who felt very significant, characters we really liked, and people who we just had good ideas for, especially if we felt there was a good mythological or historical parallel for the character that we could use for the sort of memorial concept.
But that's sort of where we wound up after a year of doing this. When we started it, well, it was more of a one-off kind of thing, because the very first one that we ever did was this one from episode 1.3.
In closing the episode, we bid a fond farewell to Captain Gadem and the finest mustache of UC-79. Tom, would you like to say a few words? So we were being very silly, but also he made such a strong impression on me.
Yeah, Space Walrus. Go ahead.
Space Walrus was a great character.
He really was.
He was a proto-Romeral.
The mustache, of course, epic. And he's not on screen all that long, but he does rather chew with the scenery when he shows up.
Well, and one of those, like, older guys who you feel like has been through some
Absolutely. So he made a huge impression on us, and when he died, we kind of wanted to do something for it. But he was also only in the show very briefly and kind of a joke character, so it was kind of a joke tribute, and we thought that that would be the end of it. That was, by the way, the only public domain rendition of Ave Maria that I could find.
I remember that being a hassle.
We briefly discussed doing a little tribute like that every time some significant character died, with just a little goodbye and play the Ave Maria song.
Mm.
That was the original idea for what we were going to do for the tributes.
That would have gotten boring.
It would have.
That's not really our jam.
Yeah, it also would have been, I think, suspiciously similar to the thing that the Colbert Report was doing for a while. Whenever a presidential candidate dropped out of the race, they did a little Hunger Games parody thing. And yeah,
I feel like a lot of people have done that. Didn't they also do it for people who worked for the Trump presidency and then left for various reasons?
I think that's right. Yes, they did. So you can see why that idea would be percolating in our minds and why we eventually decided to go in a different direction. And I think the point where we started to decide we were going to go in a different direction was this next one, episode 1.11. And if you can't tell, this was back before we upgraded our recording setup the first time. So we are still using a single microphone and passing it between us.
I was going to say, 1.11 is a full 8 episodes later. So it took a long time for us to want to do another one of these.
Yeah.
Have we done any in Zeta so far?
We have. We'll get to them towards the end of this retrospective.
Okay.
So this was for Garma and Isalina.
Two households of slightly different dignity.
Ooh, that reverb.
In bombed out New York, where we lay
so
our
tinny.
Scene. From recent grudge break to new mutiny. From forth the fatal loins of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed
lovers
take their life.
A glooming peace this morning with it brings. Go hence to have more talk of these sad things. For never was a story of more woe than this of Isalina and her Garmio.
gotta reuse that Ave Maria, since it took so long to get it in the first place.
And at this point, we still thought we were going to be using that for all of them.
New York?
Also definitely inspired.
Thanks to some bad English that was written on a map in the background, New York City in Gundamverse.
And that's why
I wonder if they
we started calling it New York, New York and continue to call it New York.
More or less.
New York.
Scenic New York City.
Yep, that was episode 1.11.
The birth of a scenic New York City. And that was the inspiration for our later audio drama, Star-Crossed Lovers.
Which was a lot of fun.
It was so good. Should every series get a Shakespeare parody? There's maybe, enough Shakespeare maybe. And it's all public domain.
Those are my favorite words. What would Zeta's Shakespeare be?
I don't know yet. I don't have a good grasp.
Oh, that's true. Like, that's true. And if I told you my thoughts, that would be a spoiler. There are definitely a bunch of Shakespeare plays where somebody goes undercover, but their disguise is just pathetically easy to see through.
If we wanted to do something with the Camille is trans, could do Twelfth Night, which has a lot of gender swapped disguises.
Mm-hmm.
I also just, other than the really famous ones, am not that familiar with a lot of Shakespeare. There's some very fringe Shakespeare that I don't really know. And I'm not as familiar with the histories, but I feel like the histories could provide excellent fodder for Gundam Shakespeare parodies.
Yeah, we'll need to bring in a Shakespearean expert for that sort of thing. It was a full 9 episodes after that we had our next tribute. And I think this is the first one where we got really serious. This was from episode 1.20, The Fate of a Soldier. This was the very, very affecting deaths of Ryu, Ramba, and Hamon.
It was the first one that we did for a character we felt like we really knew and cared about.
It was also the first one for a character on the side of the White Base. It was the first crew member to go down. And Ramba and Hamon are deservedly fan favorites.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we also really felt for the entirety of Ramba's little squad on their doomed mission.
Well, and Ramba and the weird position he finds himself in. I love this guitar.
We wanted to give Rambaral and Hamon, aka Rumba y Hamon, aka Zeon Dad and Zeon Mom, a proper send-off. But that's not what they would have wanted. Ramba came back to Earth for the sake of Hemon and his troops, so we're going to say goodbye by honoring the entire Ral team.
Second Lieutenant Akus, Zaku pilot, killed in action while fighting Amuro in the gun cannon. Second Lieutenant Kozun Graham, Zaku pilot, missing, presumed killed in action while attempting to escape captivity aboard the White Base.
Stetch, Zaku pilot, killed in action, incinerated by the White Base's engines. Gien, Zaku pilot, missing, presumed killed in action after Sela disabled his mobile suit.
Clamp and 20 commandos killed in action during hand-to-hand fighting while attempting to seize the White Base. Possibly including Zagan, motorcycle scout, presumed killed in action.
Lieutenant Tachi, Zaku pilot, killed in action by friendly fire when Amuro used his Zaku as a shield. Torgen, Misaki, Ilusin, and 13 other loyal soldiers who volunteered to join Hamon on her last mission.
And it would not feel right to leave without paying tribute to the members of the White Base crew who fell defending her. While the full count is impossible to know, we counted 7 of Kika's Oni-san Tachi killed or wounded during the battle, including Chief Petty Officer Ryu Hosei, who died valiantly defending his friends. They fought splendidly.
And finally, First Lieutenant Rambaral, 35 years old because First Gundam doesn't know how age works, son of Jimbaral, loyal soldier, betrayed by his own side, sometimes known as the Blue Giant,
and the mysterious, clever, ambitious, courageous Lady Hamon.
And now all of them together share the fate of soldiers.
I still find that super affecting.
Yeah. If you can't tell, I got really choked up during the reading of that section a couple of times. And I still get chills listening to it now. We've had some listeners tell us that tribute made them cry, and a few others that it really took them off guard.
I have chills.
Yeah.
Sometimes we do a really good job.
What? No. Didn't you hear all the mouth noises?
Not really. Unrelated to memorials in general, but we've been talking a lot about what we think Tomino sees as ideal relationships between men and women, or women's place in the world, or what he thinks of feminism. We've been talking a lot about this kind of thing. There's a relationship that we haven't talked about in a while, Ramba and Hamon.
Yeah, and I think that's a more idealized relationship.
No kids.
Even compared to Bright, Mirai, and
Hayato Fra.
Though the no kids thing might like be the crux of it, right?
Yeah.
You can either have kids or you can have an equal marriage in Tominoverse.
I mean, there might be a lot of people who feel that way, actually.
Yeah.
Logistically speaking.
Yeah. We then had the next one just two episodes later in Because of People Like You, with the death of Lieutenant Matilda. This is still one of my favorite tributes that we put together. I really liked how this one came out. When I was making this one, I definitely started crying during the editing for this segment.
Her death is very upsetting.
It really is. Like, not just in terms of her own death and the sort of snuffing out of that brilliant young life and all the potential of it, but also in the way that it affected all of the young people of the White Base crew.
And later Woody and... Yeah.
Yeah. As much as Ryu's death was a great blow and a great tragedy, it's Matilda's death that feels like the loss of innocence moment.
Yes, insofar as the way that the crew reacts to it, right? Because with Ryu, they all go to pieces and have to pull themselves together. And with Matilda, they do the soldier thing. And it's like, oh, they've already adapted to this reality where they can't go to pieces every time someone they care about dies. In honor of Lieutenant Matilda, Lawrence Binyon's Ode of Remembrance. They went with songs to the battle. They were young, straight of limb, true of eye, steady and aglow. They were staunch to the end against odds uncounted. They fell with their faces to the foe. They shall not grow old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. They mingle not with their laughing comrades again. They sit no more at familiar tables of home. They have no lot in our labor of the daytime. They sleep beyond their astral home.
Matilda-san. Boku, omou desu. Matilda-san te tsuyoi kata nan desu ne. Namaite ne.
A quick note, the original line of the ode is "They sleep beyond England's foam." We made a slight modification for Matilda Chewy.
You did a really beautiful job reading that.
Thank you. It's a good poem. Yeah, we've fallen back on a lot of poetry for these.
It's good stuff.
Well, and I'm rather fond of poetry. I like poetry a lot. And so having the opportunity and the excuse to read some new stuff and look for appropriate poems is something I really enjoy.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed a lot of the poetry that I've discovered through the process of doing these tributes. I remember now, I was editing that episode while we were visiting your parents. And it was shortly before we recorded the episode that was going to be episode 1.25, Welcome to the Jungle.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sitting in Nina's parents' living room with my laptop and my headphones on, editing this little Matilda tribute and just, like, sobbing.
Where were the rest of us?
I don't know.
Downstairs
you came over at one point and were like, are you okay? And I was like, Matilda-san.
And I was like, oh, he's all right.
I think what you actually said was, are you sure that's the only thing you're crying about? I think this next one is also really nice. I'm going to say that about all of these, I guess. I love all of my children.
Well, I don't think we've hit my favorite yet.
This next one is the tribute to Miharu, which if we ever do have the opportunity to have Tomino on the program, I would have to show him this one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is the one that made him.
He's on record as thinking that Miharu's death is like the most tragic.
Well, didn't somebody say that when they were storyboarding it, like he and a couple of the other writers were crying?
Yeah.
Like, she's such a good person.
That's
equal, right?
Like, yeah.
She's a good girl.
Yeah, it was Itano, actually, who relayed that story about Tomino and Yas, just like weeping over the storyboards for Miharu's death.
For Miharu, Ely Dear, written by Fred E. Weatherly, set to the old Irish tune, Londonderry Air. After all, the world won't be this awful forever, will it? Dear, the pipes are calling. From glen to glen and down the mountainside, the summer's gone and all the roses falling. It's I must go and you must bide, but I'll come back when summer's in the meadow, or when the valley's hushed and white with snow, and you'll be here in sunshine or in shadow. Oh Ely dear, I love you so. Someday, maybe, when all the flowers are dying, and I am dead, as dead I well may be, you'll come and find the place where I am lying, and kneel and say an Ave there for me. And I shall hear, though soft you tread above me, and all my grave will warmer, sweeter be, for you will bend and tell me that you love me, and I shall sleep in peace until you come to me.
There they are. There are the tears. Well, we're clamped over here.
We knew this was going to be an emotional episode. In case you're wondering, Ely Dear is Danny Boy. I made Nina cry. I'm so powerful.
Wasn't the first time.
You were making fun of me recently for my lack of efficiency creating the background sounds for that. The sound of the ocean and the storm took like 8 or 9 different pieces of audio that I had to layer over each other. I spent a lot of time putting that one together.
I was just thinking that next time we want to do something that's set to music, we should actually set it up so we can hear the music and recite over it. The timing worked out pretty well with yours, just sort of by chance, but if I was going to do it again.
Yeah, we could do that. We have the technology. And the next one is the immediately following episode 1.25, Welcome to the Jungle. Woody didn't make as much of an impression on us, honestly, but it was a decent one and there was still some referred fondness for Matilda.
Yeah, the parallels to Matilda's death and the very necessary shock he gives to Amuro's system. Like, he made a pretty strong impression on me. I still remember him telling Amuro, like, you're not important enough to take full responsibility for Matilda's death. That's not how this works.
Yeah.
We didn't have a chance to get to know Woody, but his death and those of the other Jaburo defenders are no less tragic. It feels appropriate, then, to honor these unnamed dead with a slightly modified text that appears on the tomb of the unknown soldier.
This music feels like it's from The Dark Crystal.
Huh.
Here rests in honored glory, soldiers known but to God.
Short and sweet.
I don't think I have anything to add to the Woody one.
After that, we did get a break. And the next one we would do would be for Slegger and Dozel. Characters we didn't like, but who made a strong impression and were very important.
Very outsized personalities.
Yeah. And ultimately, this was the first of our hate tributes. Not the last.
At the end of the Aeneid, an epic Latin poem about the foundation of the Roman race, the hero, Aeneas, Trojan survivor of the Trojan War, faces an Italian prince named Turnus from the Rutulian tribe. Turnus is a complicated figure, one neither particularly good nor particularly bad. He has good qualities and legitimate grievances, but he has also done horrible things. Among the worst, he started a disastrous war in order to win a bride who didn't want him, and he's callously butchered a young boy on the battlefield merely for the sake of glory and treasure. Aeneas, likewise, is a complicated hero. Defined by his piety and adherence to duty, he has tirelessly followed the commands of the gods, even when those commands inflicted cruel and needless suffering on innocents caught in his wake. He and his have sacrificed much to reach this point, ever since they fled the ruins of Troy. An acknowledgement of two mighty warriors with good qualities and bad, men who have done good things and bad, heroes and monsters both, I've prepared a reading for you from Book 12 of the Aeneid, lines 919 to 931, first in the original Latin, and then my own loose translation. I hope you enjoy it. And to any fellow classics nerds listening to the podcast, please do not blame my teachers. They did teach me dactylic hexameter, and there was a time when I could do it, but that was many years ago, and I am not going to relearn how to scan the Aeneid for the sake of Slegger and Dozel. They should consider themselves lucky that they are getting any kind of acknowledgement at all.
I do love when you read in Latin.
Cunctanti telum, Aeneas fatale curuscat, sortitus fortunam oculis et corpore toto, eminus intorquet, murali concita numquam, tormentos ic saxa fremunt, nec fulmine tanti disultant crepitus. Volat atri turbines instar, exitium dirum hasta ferons orasque recludit, loricae, et clipei extremus septemplicis orbis, per medium stridens transit femur, incir ictus, ingens ad terram duplicato poplite turnus, consurgunt gemitu, rutuli totusque remugit, mons circum et vocem late nemora alta remetunt, ile humilis supplex oculos dextramque precantem protendens, equidem merui, nec deprecor, inquit. Aeneas waited, then a chance, and with every ounce of his strength he hurled his flashing spear. Never had the crash of rock on city wall, nor the roll of thunder struck so loudly. The spear is a black whirlwind. It pierces the bronze rim of the seven-layered shield. It pierces the armor plate below, and with a horrible shrieking noise, it plunges through the center of the enemy's thigh. The force of it drives Turnus to the ground. A moan rises up from all his tribe gathered round. The encircling hills and the woods moan too. He extends his free arm like a suppliant and begs, "This is what I deserve. No mercy. Don't hesitate."
The The thing that you mentioned at the beginning that you're not doing, is that a tempo for reading?
Yes. In the Aeneid, every line is broken up into six dactyls. And dactyls are patterns of syllables, either like long, long, or like long, short, short. And there's a bunch of rules for how you figure out which ones are supposed to go where.
I feel like at one point you must have been really good at that, because I'm sure when we were cleaning out your childhood bedroom, we found certificates from like awards you won for reading Latin stuff.
Yeah, there was a time when I was really into it and I could do it really well. That was a long time ago.
That's okay. There was a time I could do one-armed push-ups. That time has long since passed.
Either one of us could regain this ability.
If we really wanted.
I think you're more likely to relearn how to do one-armed push-ups than I am to relearn dactylic hexameter. I had to record that one several times. I recorded it once, and I thought it was good, and then I started editing it, and I was like, oh, this doesn't, it's not there. That ain't it, Chief. So I had to go back into the booth and record it again a couple more times just to get it just right.
Inefficient.
I think the results speak for themselves.
It sounds great. I'm not saying that it doesn't sound good, but how much worse did it sound, really? No, I'm just teasing him. It turned out really well. His perfectionism is good. My let's get it done is also good. It strikes a nice balance. If it were just me, the podcast would sound a lot worse. And if it were just Tom, no episode would ever be completed.
We would still be working on the revised edition of episode one. But it would sound so good.
And Tom would be like, I don't know, maybe we should wait until we can upgrade the audio equipment again.
I have occasionally had the thought, well, if we switched to a once every 2 weeks release schedule, then I could really perfect the...
What's the line from Star Wars about a cry as if from, or as if...
Thousands of voices suddenly cried out.
Yeah.
In horror, and were suddenly silenced.
That's our listeners at the threat of having to go to a once every 2 weeks schedule.
Well, they didn't have to wait even 2 weeks after the Slager Dozel tribute for the next one, because in episode 1.30, The Assassination of McVeigh by the Esper Amuro Rey, we had a tribute for McVeigh. This was our first guest-performed tribute because Nina and I do not speak Chinese.
This was really cool. This was another one. We don't like McVeigh, but he was a very interesting character, and we came up with a cool idea. And I really enjoyed hearing the Chinese poetry recited by our friend Wen.
Well, and it was such a cool coincidence that, you know, I looked into what famous poets were there who were active during the period that McVeigh's favorite vase might have come from. And then I looked for poems that were in some way like connected to the themes of the episode or to McVeigh or to Gundam in general. And I found this one that it turned out was a very famous poem by a very famous poet, and also like one that Wen had had to recite in the past.
We bid adieu to McVeigh in this episode. He remains a puzzling villain, a man of masks and gambits. It is hard to know what to think of him, his motivations, his actions. Why did he stay behind when the rest of his fleet returned to Granada? Why did he risk everything to take out the Gundam? What secrets did those mines on Earth really contain? I suspect we'll never know the answer to any of these questions. We do know this about McVeigh. He was loyal to Caecilia, and he loved that Song Dynasty vase. So we acknowledge his passing now with a section from a poem by the Song Dynasty's most famous poet, Su Shi, about the past, the passage of time, and the brevity of human life.
I probably recorded that poet's name like 10 times, and then I asked Wen to pick which one was the best.
苏子悄然正襟危坐而问客曰何谓其然也客曰月明星稀乌鹊南飞此非曹孟德之师乎西望夏口东望武昌山川相辽玉乎苍苍此非孟德之困于周郎者乎方其破荆州下江陵顺流而东也逐卢千里 旌旗蔽空，失九临江，横槊赋诗，故一世之雄也。 而今安在哉？况吾与子于桥于江渚之上，侣鱼虾而友麋鹿，驾一叶之扁舟，举匏樽相属，寄蜉蝣于天地，渺沧海之一粟，哀无声之须臾，羡长江之无穷。挟飞仙以遨游，抱明月而长终，知不可乎骤得，托遗响于悲风。苏子曰：客亦知夫水与月乎？逝者如斯而未尝往也，盈虚者如彼而足莫消长也。盖将自其变者而观之，则天地增不能以一瞬；自其不变者而观之，则物与我皆无尽也。而又何羡乎？且夫天地之间，物各有主，苟非吾之所有，虽一毫而莫取，惟江上之清风与山间之明月，耳得之而为声，目遇之而成色，取之无尽，用之不竭，是造物者之无尽藏也，而吾与子之所共事。客喜而笑，喜盏更酌，摇盒既尽，杯盘狼藉，相与枕藉乎舟中，不知东方之既白。
And so even the tributes for us got to be really neat opportunities to learn about things that we would never have learned about before, like Song Dynasty poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was even thinking about, like, I had heard the line, "They shall not grow old as we who are left will grow old." I had never read the whole ode before I did that poem, and the recitation from the Aeneid, and you already knew about that, but I didn't. It did become a fun way to add yet another research and learning element that was very different from the other research we were doing for the podcast.
It was also one of our first opportunities to really indulge in some creative writing and some creative audio editing. You know, we get to do that now with the TNN basically every week, but in First Gundam, unless you count the recaps as creative writing, which they are, but you're also constrained in ways that make it not nearly as much fun. I assume Nina writes all the recaps.
I didn't used to, though. You wrote some of the recaps for the first season.
I wrote like 4 recaps, maybe 5.
There's about as much creativity in them as I'm comfortable writing. So it works for me, but not for Tom. Tom's imagination requires greater scope, greater freedom in which to play.
Part of the reason it's better that Nina writes the recaps is that even in those couple that I was writing, I was already definitely indulging in some creative liberties in how I was replicating the story of the episodes.
I take occasional liberties.
I occasionally didn't take liberties.
Okay. I see the difference. Would you like some more wine?
I still have some, thank you. But now I will feel emboldened to drink faster.
Splish, splish, wine pouring sounds.
Are you ready for our tribute to Lala?
No!
Too bad. The conceit of this episode requires me to play it.
We say goodbye to Commandant Watkeen with a passage.
Not Lala, Commandant Watkeen.
Jumped the gun.
Yeah.
I think I remember this one being exceptionally powerful, though.
I think I remember it now, and yeah.
We say goodbye to Commandant Watkeen with a passage from the War Diary of the poet Alan Ross, recording some of his experiences during his time aboard an escort destroyer protecting an Arctic convoy of supplies to England. The destroyers attack, drawing the enemy fire. 4 swords of flame flick into the grayness like a fencer's blow. World is a small, narrowing circle, squeezed smaller and smaller. Time has been interrupted, the clock smashed. Red-flecked, world is reduced to the gunsight's orb, its still center, a focal gray in a tilted world of sea and sky. It is too late to put the pieces together. We are going in. Across our bows, suddenly, a welter of light, an expanding cone of sluiced sounds. Again, and a shiver of steel, a moment of time displaced. the revolving bands interrupted, you didn't put the pieces together quickly enough. A storm of unleashed sound, shaken in a bowl of electric enclosure, a rainbow of light rocketing through the wrecked space, waves of explosion dancing in narrowing circles within the eyes, and like a long snake unwinding, steam hissing out in a stream over everything.
This, I think, was one of the best music and words pairings of any of the ones so far.
Well, thank you.
And one of the best edited. You edited this beautifully.
Thank you. Yeah, picking the music for them is always a challenge, but one I really relish. I take a lot of pleasure in going through all of the music that I can find that we're allowed to use.
Yeah, I mean, well, the two lessons here are there's some really fantastic music available for Creative Commons purposes, just online. You can find it. Really lovely stuff. The second lesson is when we were picking the intro and outro music for the show, Tom made me listen to hundreds of clips. And I think he could tell I wasn't into it. And now he only very rarely asks for my musical input anymore. If he's really stuck between two pieces of music, he'll ask me to be the decider. But for the most part, Tom picks the music, and after the fact, I'm like, oh, that's really nice.
So this next one should be Lala. For Lala, a broken bird who almost flew. Do you think she saw her own death the way she saw that swan's?
The Swan by F.S. Flint. Under the lily shadow and the gold and the blue and the mauve and the wind and the lilac pour down on the water, the fishes quiver. Over the green cold leaves and the rippled silver and the tarnished copper of its neck and beak, toward the deep black water beneath the arches, the swan floats slowly. Into the dark of the arch the swan floats, and into the black depth of my sorrow it bears a white rose of flame.
I think I like that one even better now than when we first did it. Well, because we keep sort of reinterpreting and reevaluating her interactions with Amuro. And so the bit in the poem about the swan entering this person's sorrow with a rose of flame, and how Lala is still a presence to Amuro in his grief.
Mm-hmm.
And the music is not very sad. Because Lala's still around. Like,
yeah.
Her death is traumatic and sad, but then we learn, like, oh, she's around.
She's just chilling.
In the Earth
around
sphere.
Earth,
yeah.
Not past Mars. There are a surprising number of poems about swans and death. We had to pick from a couple. I like the one we ended up with.
Yeah.
This next one is the last one for First Gundam. Tribute to the Zabi clan.
I can't say that we feel at all sad about the passing of Giren and Caecilia Zabi.
Or Daeguin, for that matter.
Or Daeguin. I had forgotten he died in these episodes. Forgotten about him entirely. But thus falls the House of Zabi. As Tom is always quick to point out, sic semper tyrannis.
Thus always tyrants.
If you're wondering why you've heard that before, it's famous.
It's from the assassination of Caesar. Supposedly, Brutus said it when he stabbed Caesar.
However, we would like to mark their passing. Tom has found a suitable
I think this is the first time we were gleeful during a tribute.
Alexander Posey.
Caecilia's voice actress was so good.
So good. If you haven't listened to this one in Japanese, do it. Isn't that Giren's corpse?
Giren sousui janai no ka?
The Caesars and the Alexanders were but men gone mad, who ran about a while upsetting kingdoms and were slain in turn like rabid dogs or died in misery. Assassins laid in wait for Caesar, wine amid the boasts of victory cut short the glory of the Macedonian. Deception cooled the fever Pompey had, death was dealt to Pyrrhus by a woman's hand. Themistocles and Hannibal drank deep of poison in their desolation.
We're dancing in our seats and quaffing our wine. I was going to say, didn't we do Death of a Ball Turret Gunner?
That was a Patreon bonus episode.
Okay. Because I knew we had talked about it. I was like, wait, we didn't do Ball Turret Gunner.
Was that your favorite?
I mean, it's such an incredible poem. Gruesome. I don't know that it's my favorite. Yeah, I don't know which of these was my favorite.
Well, hold on, because we've got three more. Because we're getting into season two now, if you're prepared.
But for some reason, I feel like my favorite was probably one of the ones from season one. I don't know. Mm. Let's see.
In memory of Camille's parents, the story of Uranus, sometimes called Caelus Nocturnus, who was once the god of the star-filled sky. He is at once literally the heavens, what we would call space, but also has a human-like body. Likewise, Gaia, who also figures prominently in this story, is both a human-like woman and, literally, the Earth. Uranus was a primordial creator deity in Greek mythology, and together with his consort Gaia, he sired most of the important deities in the generation that preceded the famous Olympians. In particular, he sired the Titans, including the youngest Titan, Cronus, who would himself one day be father to Zeus, Hades, Poseidon, Hera, Demeter, and Hestia. Besides being a creator, Uranus is most famous for his lust and for the horrific cruelty that he exhibited to Gaia and their children. In Hesiod's Theogony, Gaia describes him as the first being to ever commit a sin. His most famous act of cruelty was that whenever Gaia gave birth to a child whose appearance displeased Uranus, he would bind the newborn with chains and then thrust it into a tiny prison within Gaia's own body. He was not a kind and loving father to his free children, either. The myths are clear that any filial reverence they felt for him was outweighed by fear and hatred, all except for Cronus, who just hated him. The stars are coming now. The dark expanse beyond even the high heavens rushes to meet the earth, to couple with Gaia and sire on her more children. Cronus waits, hidden. He is Gaia's son, his father, Uranus, the dark of night, the sky beyond the sky. It is still the time before time, and all the cosmos is swirling chaos. Vast Gaia awaits her husband's touch with shuddering dread, her body already swollen from the tortures he has inflicted on her. Their children cower in fear, remembering the fate of their siblings. Cronus waits, hidden. He is clever and strong, like his father Uranos, but he hates his cruel and lusty sire. He is more like his father than he dares admit. He grips the handle of a sickle until his knuckles are white. It is a crude thing, made from gray flint and jagged like teeth. Gaia herself crafted it, but of all her children, only Cronus dared to take it. Heir to his father's sins, he waits as his father descends. Uranos spreads himself upon the vast earth, hungry for Gaia's embrace. His mind is turned to lusty thoughts. He rejoices in his power and his wickedness. Now, Cronus emerges from ambush. With his left, he grips his father, and with the sickle in his right, he strikes. He hacks at the immortal flesh, dismembering his father and casting each piece away to fall wherever it might. A crime for a crime. Cruelty revisited on cruelty. A cycle of violence not yet ready to end.
Is that one of your favorites?
I do think it's one of the best of them. I think it sounds really good. It's the first one we did that was like horror.
Yeah.
It's also one that I wrote entirely myself.
I was going to say, more than any other piece, it is a creative writing pursuit for you. It is a retelling of a poem or mm-hmm. a story, but it, you know, basically written from scratch by you.
And rewritten at least once after you heard the first version and were like, no one's going to get that.
It was a little too abstract.
Yeah, it was. This is why having a good editor is important. And Nina is a great editor.
One of the things I love about working with Tom is if I create an outline or notes or even just find good sources for something, I can just shove them in Tom's direction and be like, here's what I found. And he'll turn it into something totally cohesive and wonderful. Tom hates the part of like starting to structure it. And begin. Tom hates beginning. I don't mind beginning. It's the pulling it all together that leaves me staring at a screen for 4 hours.
Hmm.
So, like when we wrote the code of conduct for the patron Discord, I had been sort of taking occasional stabs at it over the course of a week. And finally just took like the couple of sentences I had written and a bunch of other notes and examples and things that I had that I liked and just gave it all to Tom and was like, here, can you make sense of this?
Well, and I couldn't have done it without that. I had no idea where to start.
That's why we're so simpatico.
High five.
High five.
Next up, this one I think might actually be my favorite.
Oh.
Yeah. And with no further ado,
in honor of the life of Lila Milaraira, the story of Atalanta, presented by Mobile Suit Breakdown.
Great music.
Atalanta, fleet of foot. Atalanta, swift of hand. Atalanta, sharp of tongue. In Arcadia, where the woods were wild, a king who wanted a son abandoned a daughter. In Arcadian forests where the baby wailed, a she-bear nursed a girl child and taught her bear kind's arts of hunt and grapple.
I want to be taught by a bear.
I'd rather be taught by
a
goose.
In deep woods, sacred to the goddess Artemis, Atalanta grew from girl to woman and learned the hunter's arts, the bow, the spear, the javelin, and the chase. Alone among women, she sailed with Jason on his Argo. Among all the greatest heroes of her age, she was swiftest, fiercest. The first men to seek the huntress as their prey were centaurs of the deep woods, all muscle and hair, as rough and evil as they were powerful. But Atalanta did not fear brutes like these.
She drew her bow. She touched her arrows. Some were fletched with white feathers, some with black. The centaurs galloped after her, but crouching low, she sprang high. As each passed beneath, groping at air, hooves snared by roots, she, falling, fired swift arrows. They buried themselves up to the white feathers. They buried themselves up to the black feathers. When her name was famous throughout the world, she returned to Arcadia, where she had been born, to her father's kingdom to claim her inheritance. Now hero and princess both, suitors came from every part of Greece to win her hand. In the days before Helen, there was no more desired bride than the virgin huntress, the she-bear of Arcadia. Atalanta looked upon the men who sought to woo her and found not one fine man among them. So she set them a test of their mettle. Behold it now, a racetrack, and two barefoot runners at one end. A javelin with a silver ring tied round its point to mark the finish line. One suitor at a time, Atalanta brought them there to race. By solemn oath, the first suitor to beat her to the finish would win her to be his bride. But when Atalanta won, and she always won, she snatched up the javelin and, swift feet still flying, leapt, turned, and hurled the deadly barb at her pursuer, killing them as once she had killed the centaurs. The number of suitors dwindled. For weeks and then for months, no one came to Arcadia to wager their life in the hope of marriage. And still she waited for one fine man who could match her. You come for Atalanta, you best not miss. That's how the saying goes, right? That's
what people say? Very famous saying.
That is a really good one.
I think you performed it beautifully.
Thank you.
I think it's
you.
A good story, and I think I wrote it pretty well for the podcast.
I quite enjoyed your writing.
I could tell you were really enjoying getting to read that one. I could feel the glee in you as you recounted Atalanta's story.
The way you wrote it had very nice tempo. I think it's easier to read action-y things with good emotion and energy than to try to read sad things with the proper emotion and energy, or to try to put energy into them, but then still have it sound sad. I think that's harder.
Yeah, totally. I do want to highlight the bit in there about the white feathers and the black feathers on Atalanta's arrows, and the arrows burying themselves up to the white feathers and the black feathers. It's one of the stock phrases that gets reused a bunch in the Tale of the Heike, which I had just finished reading at the time when I wrote this particular tribute piece, and which had been gifted to the podcast by a very generous listener and patron who would like to remind everyone here that the world needs more Sharma. The world needs more Shargarma romance.
Sharma is a really great ship name, though.
Agreed. We have one final tribute.
Okay, let's do this.
In tribute to Roberto, then, who survived the 1 year war and for 7 years after, who died under a false name far from home, holding the line so the companions who had shared his exile and eased his loneliness might escape, an adaptation from the Iliad. O rash man, O worker of violence, who with his arrows slays men and vexes even the gods that hold Olympus. Fool that he is, the brave-hearted man does not know that no mortal endures long who fights with monsters. Nor will his children ever play about his knees in later years when he has come home from the war, from the dread clash of arms. For all he is so mighty, still beware, lest he with flashing eyes meet one stronger. Lest in the night his long companion wake from sleep, made wise by some dark dreaming to unhappy tiding, and with long lamentings wake the household, all to sorrow at his defeat. All said, and even so, the Trojans surge along the line, where Apollo has opened the Greek stockade they pour, water through a levee. On every side the Greeks fall back. Unconquerable Hector with his torchbearers threatens fire for the ships.
all said and even so, three Achaean heroes stand to meet his charge. Mighty Ajax, at his right his brother Teucer. At his left, Lycophron, an exile from some foreign land, long acquainted to Ajax's house. The Trojan van they meet in gory battle. Faithful Lycophron bends his singing bow, sends barbed shafts among the foe, and fells indomitable Hector's charioteer. Enraged Hector hurls his shining spear, his thirsty javelin like the thunderbolt. But Ajax, all in gory red, stepping nimbly, shunned the well-aimed throw. All said and even so, the barbed lance through some poor flesh must pass. And in the belly of unhappy Lycophron it came to rest. An exile long sustained at Ajax's board, faithful servant to his warlike lord, in peace and war forever at his side, near his loved master, as he lived, he died. With anguish, Ajax views the piercing sight. At his bidding, Teucer rushed amidst the foe. How keen his sword, how swift his blows. Impatient Teucer with flashing eyes, through Hector's armor a gap espies. Between trembling fingers a chosen arrow draws, then hissed his arrow, then the bowstring sung. Only had the weapon found the destined way, but Hector was not doomed to perish then. The master of this hero's fate his present death withstands. The poem in honor of Roberto is from the Iliad, Book 5, the Aristia of Diomedes, and Book 15, the Defense of the Ships. It was partly inspired by the 1899 Pope translation and the 1924 Murray translation. Going into that one, I had been very affected with the death of Roberto with this idea of
someone who had already survived so much.
And then the idea that there are these different categories of people that you meet on the battlefield. And even great heroes can't survive if they fight with monsters or with gods. And so for somebody like Roberto, who is a veteran, a skilled pilot, but no Quattro, no Camille.
Just a man.
Just mortal, like most of us are. And he did well enough until he faced off against Plutarch and the Ashimar, who was on a different level. But then when I was reading through the Iliad, I got to this one section where an exile and a retainer of a more powerful hero gets killed when said more powerful hero, who is attired all in red, steps out of the way. Which was
just like sure,
just entirely too perfectly coincidental.
Wow.
And then said red attired hero tells his, in the Iliad, brother, but let's just say protege, go get revenge for me. And then the protege spots an opening in the armor of the guy who killed Lycophron and manages to hit it, but not to actually kill the enemy.
That's like too perfect. Are we sure the writers didn't study classics?
I have no idea.
If we get to meet Tomino, we're not allowed to ask questions, I'm pretty sure. I think we just have to like give him a thing to sign and say thank you and leave him alone. But if we could ask a question, I would want to know, did anybody on the writing team study classics?
So listen, we need the podcast to get so big that we are given an opportunity to ask Tomino questions. So all of you go out there, spread the good word.
I wonder a little bit if you would love or hate what we're doing.
I wonder that too. I don't think I want the answer.
I doubt we'd get a straight one. Part of me feels like he'd be flattered, and part of me feels like, while flattered, he would be like, you shouldn't spend so much time on my stupid robot show. It's not that deep, guys.
I kind of worry that at some point we're going to get like a handwritten, single-spaced, 12-page long letter, all in Japanese. It's just like everything we got wrong.
That would be a godsend. Are you kidding? If we received an actual letter from Tomino about all the stuff we've been wrong about?
Except that I would die. I would keel over and die, and the podcast would end.
I mean, that's true. That would be bad. Then you guys would all get a horribly recorded, horribly edited version of me reading the letter and talking about it. And that would be the very last episode of Mobile Suit Gundam. I'd try to find some sad music to play in the background as a memorial for Tom. I'd be like, Tomino-san, you killed my husband. I know you know what Kataki is.